The next matter before the court would be Watertown Livestock Auction Appellant versus Finn Ag Appellee, and then also a second case, Finn Ag, who is the appellant, in the second case versus Simple Inc. Appellees. My understanding is that, well, first off, the court has combined the two arguments into one session, and as all counsel are aware, we did hold oral argument on similar cases in the November term. In fact, some of the counsel here were there at that time also. My understanding is that Mr. Schaefer, on behalf of Simples, will open with 15 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, and then Mr. Henderson, on behalf of Watertown, you will go for 15 minutes also, sir?
That's correct.
All right, and then Mr. Shanks, you will, on behalf of Finn Ag, speak for 10 minutes?
Correct.
And then Mr. Van Patten, on behalf of Finn Ag, you'll speak for 20 minutes?
Yes, sir.
And that will bring us to the hour. We'll take a short break at that point, gentlemen, and then come back in and resume the case. And my understanding is at that point, then in the rebuttal, would be Mr. Schaefer for 10 minutes in the rebuttal, and then finally we would close with Mr. Henderson for 5 minutes.
Sure.
All right, gentlemen, we will then proceed. Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, sir, and you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Schaefer. I represent Simples Incorporated on an appeal from Fine Ag's case where Judge Rush granted summary judgment in favor of Simples on Fine Ag's conversion claim. Judge Rush held that the Food Security Act barred the conversion claim. This case raises important questions where the lender knows of an assumed name under which its debtor or borrower is doing business, potentially subjecting farm products to its security interests and to other purchasers who buy those products. Now, in this particular case, it involves sales from C&M Dairy to Simples beginning April 13 of 2003, ending July 23 of 2004. Judge Rush held as a matter of law that all claims prior to April 13th were barred by the two-year statute of limitations, and Fine Ag has not appealed from that ruling. So the only claims that are on this appeal involve claims that occurred 2 years prior to the commencement of Fine Ag's action against Simples. Now, Fine Ag entered into a lending relationship with the Burwalds on June 27 of 2002, made loans to the Burwald brothers, Calvin Burwald, Michael Burwald, Kimberly Burwald, and Sakota Dairy. Fine Ag shortly thereafter filed effective financing statements with the Secretary of State listing dairy cattle and milk as the products. At the very inception of this relationship between Fine Ag and the Burwalds, Fine Ag was on notice that the Burwalds did business under the name of C&M Dairy. At the very first transaction that took place involved a number of purchases of cattle by Fine Ag. One of those purchases in Watertown, South Dakota, was for a number of Holstein heifers that the Burwalds purchased under the name of C-M Dairy. Calvin Burwald submitted to Fine Ag a disbursement request and asked Fine Ag to pay for those cattle. Fine Ag turned around and did pay for those cattle. Thereafter, in October of 2002, a lawsuit was started by Van Beek Scientific against Calvin Burwald, Michael Burwald, and Calvin and Michael Burwald doing business as C&M Dairy, and Fine Ag Inc. Paragraph 4 of that complaint alleged that Calvin and Michael Burwald did business as C&M Dairy. Fine Ag, with the same law firm that represents Fine Ag in all of these cases, answered that complaint and admitted paragraph 4. Judicially admitted that it knew that Calvin and Michael Burwald were doing business as C&M Dairy as of November 2, 2002, well before any of the sales that are the subject of our lawsuit. FINAG, however, failed and refused to amend its effective financing statement to include C&M Dairy as an additional debtor, which it was clearly required to do and clearly entitled to do. Now, Simples is a meat packing and processing plant. We purchase livestock for slaughter. They're brought to the plant in many fashions, often by truckers or other people that deliver them. When the person delivering the cattle drops them off, we are told who the seller is. A delivery receipt is prepared listing the seller, listing the number of head of cattle, the weight of cattle, and their condition, and it's signed by the person making the delivery. In this case, all of the cattle that were delivered to Simples were delivered under the name of C&M Dairy, with C&M Dairy as a seller.
Mr. Schaefer, help me with the record. Is there anything in the record about the actual legal status of C&M Dairy? In other words, was it a joint venture? Was it an informal partnership, a formal partnership? I haven't seen anything in the record in any of these four cases we're going to have now that really reflect what that animal was.
Well, we believe that C&M Dairy was a DBA of the Burwells. That's what we believe. Now, when Simples got the cattle, I mean, we list them under C&M Dairy, and this is part of the record. We sent out a payer or a payee information card that went out in September of 2003 to C&M Dairy in care of Arlen Burwald, and we asked that to be returned. It was returned to us in September of 2003. It listed Arlen Burwald. It listed his address, which, by the way, is not the same address of any of the other debtors. The other debtors all listed Route 1, Box 30. They never listed a street address. And to this day, if you look it up on the Internet, Calvin Burwald doesn't list that address, even though he claims that he lived with his dad. It lists the contact person is Arlen Burwald. It lists Arlen Burwald's Social Security number. When I presented this to him in his deposition, he says, yeah, that looks like my writing up here. Then pretty soon he said, it doesn't look like my writing. And then by the end, we don't know whose it is. But this is the information that was provided to my client as to who C&M Dairy was.
Now, I don't see C&M Dairy on that exhibit.
It says it right here, C&M Dairy.
Oh, okay.
It was written in and sent to them with the payee information request.
Is that his writing on C&M?
No, that's not his writing. That's the writing of someone from Simples that sent it there to ask it to be filled out.
All right.
So none of that matches up with anything that's on any of the EFS filings to give Simples notice that any of these people should have been put on the check, that FINAG should have been put on the check.
And Arlen was not a debtor here.
Arlen was not a debtor.
But see, that's a completely different situation than Watertown livestock sales, because there, when somebody is, say, a seller, like if C&M is a, C&M Dairy is a seller, the C is Calvin Burwald, and the M is Michael Burwald, and not the father, Arlen, who sold the business years ago and has no interest in it. But Watertown Dairy, then, is on notice of, I mean, they can't deal with C&M Dairy without dealing with Calvin Burwald, who's delivering the cattle, or Michael Burwald, who's delivering the cattle. So it's a completely different situation than what you have there.
Well, that may be true, and I'm not going to argue their case one way or the other, but I'm saying that Simples did what it could to determine who C&M Dairy was and was provided with this information. Now, the FINAG was required to list on its EFS and to amend that EFS if it became aware of information which made it incorrect or wouldn't give people notice. Now, clearly, when they judicially admitted that the Burwalds did business at C&M Dairy, they should have amended their EFS statement and put C&M Dairy on there. Simples never got noticed because there was no way for us to get noticed. When we look at C&M Dairy, there's still no listing for C&M Dairy at the Secretary of State in the state of South Dakota. Now, the purpose of the Food Security Act was to abrogate the farm products exception. It was originally codified at 9307 and is now codified at 9320. It was to shift the burden of loss from the buyer to the lender. The lender was obligated to police its own loan and take into account its collateral. And the law was intended to preempt state law to the extent necessary to achieve the goals of the legislation. Now, in this case, under subsection D, the buyer in the ordinary course, and I don't think there's any dispute about what Simples was a buyer in the ordinary course, takes free of the security interest created by the seller, even if the security interest is perfected, and even if it knows of the security interest, subject only to three exceptions. And the one exception that applies in this case is E3. And under that exception, the statute says, in the case of farm products produced in a state that has established a central filing system, which is true here, the buyer receives from the Secretary of State of such state written notice that specifies both the buyer and the farm product being sold, or both the seller and the farm product being sold by such seller, as being subject to an effective financing statement. This statute contemplates that Simples is entitled to get actual notice of who, that this is subject to an effective financing statement. We never got it. We couldn't get it. And as Judge Rush said, the argument that they're making is, well, Simples was registered as a buyer. They got the master list. We're on the master list. End of case. The court can conclude that they got notice. That's not true in this case, where there's a DBA or an assumed name. Now, under this security agreement that Finang had with the Burwalds, under the security agreement, Finang required the Burwalds to advise them of any changes in their name or any changes in any assumed business names. That's part of the security agreement. They also never so much as even to police the loan checked or counted the cattle until almost 2 years after the loan began.
Of course, those are different issues. Those aren't issues which determine whether or not the seller was selling the property or whether or not the seller actually created the security interest. Under your proposal here, anybody can actually void or bypass a properly filed effective financing statement just by sending somebody else down there just by sending Joe Blow down there to deliver the cattle and to give them a fictitious name as to who the seller of the cattle is. And you say that protects Simples.
Well, that's not what happened in this case.
Well, they're sending Arlen Burwald, who's not the owner of the property. He might be the former owner of some of the property because apparently the record says that he sold whatever interest he had to his sons, Calvin and Michael. And so they're sending him down there as simply an agent to sell the property.
Well, the point is that Fine Ag under the legislative scheme is obligated to police its loan. Fine Ag knew that the Burwalds were doing business at C&M Dairy and judicially admitted it. And if they would have simply either policed their loan or put C&M Dairy on the effective financing statement, we wouldn't be here. And as far as the legislative history and parsing these words created by the seller, I think in this case, the Burwalds are the sellers under a DBA C&M Dairy. But under the legislative history, and I looked at...
Don't they have notice of Calvin and Michael doing business as C&M?
We don't have notice of it because when the cattle are delivered to us at C&M Dairy and we look up C&M Dairy on the master list, it doesn't show up.
But how can you even find out who C&M Dairy is without knowing who's delivering the cattle, whether it's Calvin, Michael, or Arlen, or anybody else? without, see, you're taking somebody's word for it, it's C&M Dairy, and that's what's bothering me.
Well, Judge, under the legislative history, Congress said the buyer is not required to go out and do lien searches and do searches to determine who the creditors or lenders are. We're not required to get no lien certificates. We're not required to do that. Now, actually, I looked at the legislative history because of this argument that they're raising about this created by the seller and this trying to play word games. And the legislative history is very clear. And it's at appendix, it's page 38 of our appendix. It says, it provides that a buyer of farm products takes those commodities free and clear of any security interest in those goods unless the buyer has received written notice of the lien from the lender or seller. It talks about any security interest. And that was the intent of Congress.
Except it has to have been created by the seller.
That's not what the legislative history says. But even if we assume that the
Act says that, though.
The Act says that. But even if we assume, you can't reach an absurd result. Congress intended to abrogate the farm products exception that was creating problems and that was resulting in double payment. And that's exactly the situation that they're putting us in here today. But the problem is the legislative history says any security interests. And I think you have to look at the legislative history when interpreting the language of the statute to see what results you're going to reach in this case. Because you can't, I see my time is up, apply the language to reach an absurd result that was never intended by Congress.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Mr. Henderson, you have 15 minutes, sir. And I guess I didn't introduce maybe as clearly as I should have. You represent Watertown Livestock, correct, sir?
That's correct.
All right, you have 15 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Henderson, and as you indicated, Chief Justice Gilbertson, I represent Watertown Livestock Auction Incorporated. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the facts because the facts are similar, but I do want to point out a little bit about our circumstances here. Watertown Livestock is a commission merchant under the Food Security Act, a livestock barn located in Watertown, South Dakota. What our case involves is very similar to Simple's case. What our case involves are cattle that were sold at Watertown Livestock. Watertown Livestock, of course, is not the buyer. The buyer is a third party. They are essentially the commission merchant, the agent that conducts the sale and makes a commission. It's essentially the same situation, though, in that what happens at Watertown Livestock is when the cattle are delivered to Watertown Livestock, they're unloaded, and information is taken from whoever makes the delivery of the cattle as to who the seller is and who the check should be written to. In our case, the name provided to Watertown Livestock was C&M Dairy. And, of course, when Watertown...
That was provided by whom? Calvin? Was that provided by Calvin or Michael Burwell?
I don't think the record is entirely clear, and in many cases it may have been provided by different individuals.
Do you have any evidence in the record that it was provided by somebody other than Calvin or Michael?
I don't think that there's any evidence that's clear in the record as to who delivered it at all. So I guess the answer to that is no.
There is evidence in the record, isn't there, that Watertown supposedly knew the Burwalds and C&M Dairy for a period of 8 or 10 years or something like this. And you can't know C&M Dairy without knowing either Michael or Calvin Burwald, can you?
Well, there is evidence in the record, you're correct, Justice Sabers, that the name C&M Dairy had been used by the Burwalds to sell cattle at Watertown Livestock since at least 1994. I believe that Calvin Burwald, in his deposition, testified that we've been using that name to sell cattle at Watertown Livestock for 10 years, and that's the only name they know us by. It was essentially, and I don't know if that is his testimony verbatim, but essentially what he testifies is that's how they know us, as C&M Dairy.
Didn't he say that's the only way these people, that being Watertown, know us?
Correct. That's correct, Justice Inter. That is what Calvin Burwell testified to. And I want to spend just a brief time, and my time is limited, so I want to touch on some other issues as well, but I want to spend just a brief time reiterating that we agree with Mr. Schaefer's argument regarding the interpretation of the Food Security Act. We believe that as a commission merchant, Watertown Livestock is entitled to the protection of the Food Security Act. The exception that Fine Egg relies on to the general rule of the Food Security Act indicates that the written notice has to specify both the seller and the farm products being sold. I think that the inclusion of the term specify is important because it indicates that they have to provide very specific information that is sufficient to let anybody, whether it's a buyer or a commission merchant, selling livestock, to put them on notice of probably whatever information that a reasonable person would need to ascertain that there is a security interest in these particular livestock.
But isn't the Farm Service Act designed to protect innocent merchants, innocent commission merchants, and not protect, say, merchants who are collusive with the seller and saying, well, we know who you really are, but you know, if you operate under this name that's not on the master list, we can just make the check out to you. I'm not saying that's necessarily happening with Watertown, but certainly there's some suggestion of that here. And I guess I'm concerned about whether the Farm Service Act goes that far to protect collusive agents who aren't necessarily innocent, who want to keep the cattle coming and keep the commissions coming, so they kind of wink at who's bringing in the cattle and who the real seller is.
Justice Konenkamp, to answer your question, first of all, I don't think that there's any evidence. There's certainly not sufficient evidence to conclude as a matter of law that there was any type of collusive behavior or conduct here.
Would that be a question of fact, though?
Yeah. If there is, if the court construes some evidence that there may have been some collusive behavior here, I think it is a question of fact, because I don't think that there is any evidence which could show us as a matter of law that that was the case. But to answer your question, I don't. The Food Security Act is clear that I don't mean to suggest that this goes so far to protect collusive behavior, but it is clear that even where the security interest has been perfected, and even where the commission merchant knows of the security interest, has actual knowledge of the security interest, they're still protected unless Fine Egg, the creditor in this case, falls within that exception. And I think it's probably inconsistent with legislative history to say that, well, that means we can engage in collusive behavior and engage in fraud. And I wouldn't read it that far, but it is clear that they can have knowledge.
And your people had knowledge that Calvin Burwald had created a security interest in this property, and that Michael Burwald had created a security interest in this property, and other Burwalds had created and that's how they knew who these people were over the last 10 years or 8 years or whatever it is in the record.
Well, as I indicated, Calvin Burwald's testimony was that's the only thing they knew us by was CNM Dairy.
I know, but you're talking to Calvin Burwald, or say Calvin Burwald is delivering the cattle, and you can't know who the seller is until, say, somebody labels somebody the seller, and the guy that's doing the labeling is the guy who has created a security interest, and your people have knowledge of that.
Well, but I think the point is that the FSA requires that the EFS specify the seller. I think that, like I said, that the use of the word specify is important because it shows that the EFS has to include all information that could reasonably be necessary for a party in the place of Watertown Livestock to ascertain that there is a security interest. And that would include a DBA, particularly in the case when, as here, Fine Egg had an actual knowledge that the Burwalds were using CNM Dairy as a DBA.
So you're proposing a rule where anybody can bypass an effective financing statement and security agreement simply by having, you know, one of their hired men or something deliver cattle to your client and saying it's Santa Claus or Bugs Bunny or someone else selling the cattle?
First of all, I don't. That's not what the facts are here, and I think it's important that this was not unusual. This was nothing new. The cattle were being sold at Watertown Livestock under the name C&M Dairy. That went on for 8 to 10 years before Feinegg ever had a security interest.
And apparently, from the time the security interests were properly created, your people had knowledge that Calvin Burwald and Michael Burwald had created security interests, and so their name could have been put on the check.
Their name could have been put on the check, and certainly their name appeared on the master list. But I would go back to my interpretation of the FSA. And one thing I want to point out is there's always going to be a scenario, I believe, where a debtor who is intent on avoiding a security interest and is determined to do so can act fraudulently and can figure out a way to get around the security interest and sell the cattle free of the security interest.
Where did Judge Tim err?
I'm sorry?
Where did Judge Tim err?
In two ways, I think. One, at least two ways. One in his interpretation of the FSA, and the other is on the issue of damages, which I'd like to touch on as well. It's clear that damages are an essential element of a conversion claim. Courts across the country have held that. This court has recognized that in the ChemH Industries versus Glover case. The court indicated that conversion is an unwanted interference by a defendant with dominion over the property of plaintiff from which injury to the latter results. Clearly, injury damages is an essential part of the claim.
And if you're right on that, then there would be genuine issues of material fact that would have to go back to the trial court to decide?
I think two things, I guess. One, we point out in our brief that they've never alleged damages here. They've never made any allegation that they suffered actual injury as a result of Watertown Livestock's actions. But assuming that you know, we think that failure means that we should be entitled to summary judgment, but
they didn't
that's
get,
not true. I think it's a question
of fact.
They didn't
get paid. Isn't that a damage?
Well, the situation is unique, I think, in that two things, I guess. The reality is, number one, Calvin Burwald has testified that every dime that he received went back into the operation for feed or for other cattle.
Great for the Burwalds. What's it do for Feinegg?
Well, it maintains their herd of cattle, in which Feinegg has a security interest, and it also provides sustenance for that herd of cattle. And Feinegg is in this case, you know, significantly oversecured, so they continue to hold that security interest in the new cattle that are bought. The other thing is the unique part about this is the fact that the Burwalds are in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. There's been a Chapter 11 bankruptcy plan that Feinegg voted to accept. That plan was confirmed by Judge Hoyt.
But, you know, whether they'll be paid out under that, that's purely speculative. I mean, we're all aware of hundreds and hundreds of reorganization plans where somebody who appears to be over-secured does not ends up either getting the property back or doesn't get paid out completely.
Right, and I would respond in two ways to that. I agree that you know their point, Feinegg's point is, we don't know for sure that we're going to be paid in the bankruptcy, even though we've been paid so far. My point would be that if that's the case, then your damages are purely speculative, and they haven't been realized yet. I don't think that you can recover for damages that are based entirely on speculation and say, we're getting paid, but there's a possibility that we might not get paid. The other point I would make is the reality, and Feinegg's filings don't recognize this, but if the Burwalds default on payments that they're required to make under the bankruptcy plan, Feinegg has the immediate right to enforce their security interest, to foreclose on the Burwalds, and the bankruptcy papers that were a part of the record with the trial court make it clear that Feinegg is significantly oversecured in this claim. So the reality is they're going to be paid.
We've had repeated cases where when a creditor goes out to pick up the cattle, they're simply not there for paper cattle.
True, and that's why the Food Security Act gives substantial power to the and puts the responsibility on the lender to supervise the activities of the debtor. They can do inspections when they want to. They can require the seller to provide lists of who they're selling to. They can count the livestock. There's no evidence that any of that was ever done in this case. I want to touch briefly on the...
Can I ask you one question?
Yes, I'm sorry.
If Judge Timm's decision is affirmed, is your client subordinated to their claim against the Burwalds? In other words, if bankruptcy fully pays out the Burwalds, then are you next in line? Are you subordinated to FinAg's secured position?
First of all, I don't probably know enough about bankruptcy to give you a clear, direct answer to that question. I'd like to think that was the case, and I'd certainly that's the position I would take, but I don't know about the mechanisms of bankruptcy.
That's an alternative position on your client's part, then.
I'm sorry?
That's an alternative position on your client's part.
Well, certainly if Judge Tim's position were affirmed, I think that's a position our client would take. I'd like to talk briefly about the Benning case, which...
But before you do that... How are you going if they've gone through bankruptcy? How are you going to assert that subordinated claim, quote unquote, after the bankruptcy is over? You're not going to be able to come back against Burwalds if they've recovered if FinAg's recovered all their money from you. How are you going to go after them after the bankruptcy is over?
Right, and that may well be true. You know, there's not the bankruptcy. The plan is still in effect, but you're right in that. I don't know enough about mechanisms of bankruptcy to know whether we'd have a valid claim or not.
The flip side of that, though, also is you're not entitled to summary judgment on this issue because what if FinAg hadn't started their case within 24 months, expecting to get paid off in the bankruptcy, and then the bankruptcy doesn't work. They're barred by 609.1.
Well,
so they've got to file their claim.
And that's true. They have to file their claim to protect themselves.
So you're not entitled to summary judgment on the damage issue.
And that may well be true, Justice Inter. I think that the damage issue, I guess my only basis for saying we would be entitled to summary judgment is that they haven't even alleged damages here. Okay. But if we get past that, I think the damages are clearly a question of fact. These damages have not yet been realized. At the very least, I think it's premature to say that FinAg was damaged in this case, in which they, in all likelihood, will be paid through the bankruptcy. I see my time is up.
Yes, so. Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Mr. Shanks, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you appear on behalf of FinAg for those that are listening on the internet.
So is it FinAg or FinAg?
It is pronounced FinAg.
Okay.
I stand correct.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Shanks, along with co-counsel Jonathan Van Patten. We're here today representing FinAg. I will be addressing the Watertown Livestock Appeal in my 10 minutes. Mr. Van Patten will be handling the Simples Appeal in the remaining 20 minutes. I would like to discuss four issues before the court today. First, I will briefly discuss the purpose of the application of the Food Security Act as it applies to the Watertown Livestock case, the liability of Watertown Livestock for the sales in which it acted as a lender, the proof of conversion based upon Watertown's livestock's claim that we failed to prove our damages, and lastly, the argument that FinAg failed to mitigate its damages. FinAg's position regarding the application and purpose of the Food Security Act has been clear. The Act only protects buyers and sale barns for those security interests that are created by the seller. So in this particular case, whether the seller was the Burwalds or C&M Dairy, the cattle could not be sold free of FinAg security interests. Mr. Van Patten will be going into further detail on the purpose and the application of the Act and some background in light of the Huffnagel decision, but I wanted the court to be aware that we are continuing that, are continuing to represent to this court that the Food Security Act does not provide protection to Watertown Livestock. Watertown Livestock is liable at a minimum for those sales in which it acted as a lender by allowing the Burwalds to buy cattle on credit and then Watertown Livestock later retained proceeds from the sale of collateral cattle. A party who retains the proceeds from the sale of farm products is acting as a lender instead of a party protected by the Food Security Act. That was noted in the Food Services of America versus Royal Heights case. Therefore, a party who seeks to retain the proceeds from the sale of farm products in repayment of an obligation must look to state law to determine the priority of interest. And that's what we were asking this court to do for approximately, I believe, it was about $45,000 worth of sales where the Burwalds would come in. And in particular, if you look at the appendix in our brief, we have all of those sales listed. The most notable one, we believe, is the first one in Appendix A, where Mike Burwald comes in on January 28th of 2003, sells 26 head of cattle, and Sienna Dairy also sells 15 head of cattle on that day. Watertown Livestock, after that sale, cuts a check to Mike Burwald and Fine Ag and Dakota Bank.
So wait a minute, on those facts, on the same day you have both the Burwalds and C&M selling?
Correct.
What did the judge do with that, anything?
In that particular, well, he held that we won on both instances, Judge Tim did. However, in particular, he also held that for the sale on Mike Burwald, we won because Watertown Livestock was acting as a lender. And what happened was they had not been paid for a previous purchase by the Burwalds. And so they voided the check that had Mike Burwald's name and Fine Egg's name on it, and then made the check payable to C&M Dairy, or excuse me, to Watertown Livestock. In essence, they paid themselves for the previous shortfall on the purchase. And the remaining sales that we've outlined in our appendixes are similar instances where they're paying themselves back, they're lending money out to pay the seller in order to cover for the Burwalds when they don't pay.
Is this a question of fact? Or why isn't it a question of fact? Maybe I should say that.
Well, we don't believe it creates a question of fact, because the fact is that they actually paid the money out and loaned the money and then later recovered it from the Burwalds. I don't know that there is a genuine issue. I know Justice Konenkamp indicated we had maybe a collusiveness there, and whether that creates a question of fact. I don't believe that's the case. We don't have to determine whether they are being collusive or not. We just have to look to see where they're lending the money out and creating an obligation or a debt, acting as a lender, and then trying to recover.
But what about the transactions where there wasn't a lending transaction? It was just they were just acting as the auctioneer or the sales agent. Some of those too?
For those where they're acting it. Now we're looking at the sales where they weren't acting as a lender, the remaining sales.
Right.
Then we look to the Food Security Act and whether that provides protection. And again, we come back and say whether they were seeing a dairy or the Burwalds, they're not protected under the Food Security Act.
Was this case tried as a collusive case? Was there evidence? Was there ever any suggestion in the record about this being a collusive situation with Watertown? I don't recall reading anything about that.
We didn't assert that, Your Honor. I mean, I don't know that it's material to determining what the outcome of the case is, whether they're acting in courts with the Burwalds or not. We don't believe is dispositive.
But it is something to think about as far as this fictitious name or fronting situations or the various ways people have used to defraud their creditors.
Sure. We agree that you don't want sale barns out there working in with debtors and defrauding lenders. What is in the record in this particular case, and what I can argue, I guess, based upon that record, is that this is what they did. They had a prior sale that the prior purchase the Burwalds didn't pay for. They covered that purchase, and then they sought to become some type of super creditor and jump ahead of all of the other secured creditors and take the collateral cattle proceeds. There's no support, and I know the Mr. Henderson is identified in his brief that the purchase or the Stockyards Act somehow they were obligated to make this payment, but there's nothing in the Packers and Stockyards Act that says that just because they pay out that money, that somehow they get to come back in and jump in front of all of the other secured lenders. Regarding the proof of conversion, there is evidence in the record in Bob Goetz's affidavit on page 186 that the cattle sold by the Burwalds under the name of C&M Dairy were collateral cattle. He further stated that Fine Ag immediately notified Watertown Livestock that Fine Ag was to be listed as the co-payee, that the Burwalds were not authorized to sell the cattle, that Fine Ag had not waived its rights or its security interests of the cattle, and Fine Ag did not receive any of the proceeds. Jolene Steiner of Watertown Livestock, in the record on page, I believe it's 190, and pages 230 and 231, acknowledged that C&M Dairy was Calvin Burwald of Toronto, South Dakota, and that they had been selling cattle at Watertown Livestock for quite some time. And Calvin Burwald also testified in his deposition that all the cattle were owned by the Burwalds. So what it comes down to is all the cattle that were sold there were secured cattle, and I think what Watertown's argument is to try to remand this case because we didn't list all the cattle in the EFS. We listed dairy cattle and milk. And I guess I come back to the Farmers and Merchant State Bank versus Tevedal case where the bank included a description of all cattle, hogs, sheep, hereafter required, and any increases, but then they failed to list specifically hogs in the EFS.
That's a UCC case, though. This is an EFS case. And the rules are appear to me to be more strict.
Well, the Food Security Act, I believe, Your Honor, was applicable to that case and was cited by the court. And I guess my understanding and reading of the case was this court determined that the financing statement wasn't considered insufficient by failing to provide the code number for all collateral cattle, or in that particular case, the hogs, and that by providing the information in the UCC that the hogs and cattle and sheep are all secured, that that was sufficient to meet the requirements and to give notice. Based upon that, we believe that Fine Ag has established damages, and we would request the court uphold the conversion claim and in our damages claim. Finally, in regard to the Benning case, we don't believe that Benning is applicable. One thing the court needs to look at is their argument is failure to mitigate. And mitigation arguments come after the conversion act occurs. In Benning, the bank advanced additional money after they determined that there was a breach. They allowed additional payments to judgment creditors who had junior interests, and they failed to offset funds that were in the bank. Fine Ag filed suit after it learned of the default. It pursued recovery against the other sale barns, and it just simply cannot wait to find out if there's other remedies out there because of the two-year statute of limitations. I see that my time is up, and we ask the court to uphold the lower court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shanks. Mr. Grand Patton, then, on behalf of Fine Ag, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jonathan Van Patten, and I am appearing on behalf of Fine Ag and addressing the Simples appeal and responding to the arguments there. Opposing counsel has made what is essentially a policy-based argument, emphasizing how difficult it is for a buyer of farm products to discover whether there's a security interest. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Huffnagel, Fine Ag versus Huffnagel, recognized that difficulty, but they said, we are constrained to apply the plain language of the statutes as enacted both by Congress and the Minnesota legislature and to follow where they lead.
The statutes don't define seller, though. Isn't that a problem with the Minnesota Supreme Court case? They say, yeah, we're constrained to follow the statutes, but the statutes don't define, the Food Security Act doesn't define seller.
Yes, Your Honor, and as we addressed in our brief, the definition that is closest is from the UCC and the there the seller is defined as a person. And here we don't have a person. We have at most a DBA, a name. The Minnesota court, what they did, there was some ambiguity in terms of how to decide the case. The lower court, the Court of Appeal, treated the debtor as the seller, saying it had constructive possession of the corn in that case, although the debtor in that case had sent, in one instance, had sent employees, another instance had sent his minor sons to do the transaction. The Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the lender on the basis of the debtor being the seller. Now, in these cases, the defendants basically have argued, no, C&M Dairy is the seller. And the Minnesota court says it doesn't matter. And if I may read the language there, they said you could look at it either way. And this is 720 Northwest 2nd at 585 and 586. Court said, under the facts of this case, no matter what factual assumptions we make, there are none under which Meschke, the buyer, could take the corn free of Fine Ag security interest. This is because if we view Buck, the debtor, as the seller, we must conclude that the buyer's rights are subject to Fine Ag security interest under Section 1631 because Fine Ag filed an effective financing statement that put the buyer on notice of Fine Ag security interest in Buck's products. And if we view the employees or the minor sons as the sellers, we must conclude that the buyer's rights are subject to Fine Ag security interest under either Section 1631 or the Minnesota's UCC because both statutes only protect a buyer from a security interest created by the seller and not from a security interest created by an undisclosed owner, which continues in the product despite the sale. I think the basic problem with Mr. Schaefer's presentation, grounded in policy, is that it doesn't take into account the words of the statute and certainly does not take into account the decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court in Fine Ag versus Huffnagel.
Now, Mr. Van Patten, analysis, if you're talking about the simple case, you've appeared as the respondent in the other three. In this one, you're the appellant. Standards of review loom high with this court. Do you have any thoughts on whether there's a difference in this case because you're the appellant versus the other three where you're the respondent?
Well, in this case, there were cross motions for summary judgment, which indicates, not conclusive, but indicates that both sides believe that this was a question of law, of interpretation of the statute. And so as reflects the standard, it is de novo on interpretation. I think there the playing field is level. Now, whether the party opposing the summary judgment, there may be inferences in a particular case, and in this case, I think they are leaning heavily on their postcard and the fact that Arlen Burwald made some of the deliveries. I would point out to the court that it's a little bit like the tail wagging the dog. Arlen Burwald was not that involved. In his deposition, I believe these pages are attached to Mr. Schaefer's affidavit in support of summary judgment. But in Mr. Arlen Burwald's deposition, he was asked, and there were over 100 deliveries made to Simples. He was asked, would you agree that you made only 9 deliveries between July of 2002 and July of 2004 to Simples? And the answer is yes. Earlier I made a lot of trips. Lately I haven't made so many. So as to the transactions in question, he made approximately 10% of the deliveries. I think the real question here is what does the statute say? And the Huffnagel case says the plain language of the statute favors a secured lender. And here's why. I believe the reading of the statute that both Mr. Schaefer and Mr. Henderson need in order to win would be to take 1631D and essentially strike out the words created by the seller, probably substitute any for A, and have the statute read as follows. A buyer who in the ordinary course of business buys a farm product from a seller engaged in farming operations shall take free of any security interest, period. That's not what the statute says. It says takes free of any security interest created by the seller. Now, where does that language come from? Is that just some sort of legislative glitch? I don't think so. It comes from the UCC, and as described by the Huffnagel Court, it was there to essentially deal with the security interest of undisclosed owners, which is exactly this case.
And, though, under the UCC, lots of courts have held, they've pierced the veil or used alter ego analysis to disregard the nominal seller to find that, in actuality, it was created by the seller, even though the person who had possession really wasn't.
Well, I believe I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I believe the purpose of the rule is essentially like the common law know your seller rule. And this is the problem whenever you're dealing with sellers of personal property. We see that, for example, in the UCC. It would be 57A2-403, incorporating the common law rule that basically a buyer cannot receive greater title than the seller has. And C&M Dairy, in essence, if C&M Dairy is treated like the seller, they are like a thief. And the buyer can't get any greater title than C&M Dairy could convey. And C&M Dairy doesn't have the capacity to convey. That's a situation that confronts all buyers of property in South Dakota. And so the basic common law rule describes a fundamental rule of property law is that you have to know your seller. And that makes
it. That rule, though, the know your own seller rule, I mean, that's just directly contrary to the purpose, philosophy, and everything about the Food Security Act.
Not everything. It's clear that the purpose of the Food Security Act is to give greater protection to buyers. But the Minnesota court in Huffnagel said that was a limited protection. The buyer takes free of security interests created by the seller and remains subject to security interests created by others, in this case an undisclosed buyer. I think the question in the case then comes down to whether a FINAG had an effective financing statement. Now, Mr. Schaefer made the argument that they were required by the statute to amend the financing statement because there was a material change. I think he has oversold what the statute requires. First of all, under the statute, talking about the definition of an effective financing statement, this would be 1631C4C, definition of an effective financing statement, C4C. Sub 2, under that section, says that the effective financing statement is to list the name and address of the person indebted to the secured party. Sub 3 follows with some kind of appropriate number identification, either Social Security number or a tax ID. Now, that's what the statute says, that you're to list the names of the debtor. C&M Dairy is not a debtor, never was, and still is not. It's a nothing. It is a name. But the statute says you are to list the debtors. Don't list any. I mean, there's not a line to list anyone else.
What about the DBA argument we heard from opposing counsel? What do you do with that?
Well, as I understand it, he says you have to list everyone that you suspect might be dealing in the products, but the statute says that you have to list the debtors. And so then the question is, well, because he said, well, the statute is talking about this EFS in terms of providing appropriate information. It says that there's a material change that has occurred. We believe not. If you look at the regulations now, and they're provided in the appendix, so number 7 to in Mr. Schaefer's brief, there's actually two parts. The 9 CFR 205-100 section, those are actually regulations, and the 200 section are the interpretations by USDA. We believe that the definition, it's actually in the interpretation part, is in 205.209, and that deals with amending the EFS, and it defines material change. This is 205.209 sub A. Now, and this is actually an interpretation by USDA, but it defines what is a material change. I could read that entire paragraph, but I would just say that paragraph is focused on changes in the collateral. It talks about the product. That's where the focus is, material changes in the product. Certainly, if there's another debtor to be listed, that would be something that would be reflected on the ESF, but not a name. There's no place for it. And what the regulations are focused on is a change in the collateral. It does go on in 205.209 sub B to give an example, which is similar to this case, talking about an owner of a product that makes a unilateral change without notifying the secured lender. But that provision also is talking about the change in the collateral. Somebody has a security interest, say like the Tevadol case, there's a security interest in one type of livestock, and the debtor buys a different type of livestock without notifying the lender. And actually in that section, the USDA says the consequences of that are unclear from the statute. What is clear from the statute is that a requirement of a material change relates to the collateral and would relate to the debtors if there's a change in the debtors, but there never was a change in the debtors. And so even if all of the stuff that Mr. Schaefer is talking about were attributed to Fine Ag, which is far more ambivalent than he makes it out to be. I mean, if someone is purchasing cattle, that's not the same as selling secured cattle. If one is admitting in a complaint that C&M Dairy does business, or the Burwalds do business using the name C&M Dairy, that's not the same as Fine Ag admitting that they know that C&M Dairy is selling secured collateral. So his argument there, that he pushes, I think he pushes the evidence too far, but in any event, for summary judgment purposes, what we're saying is material change under the statute is not required in this case because we do not have a change in the debtors. And so what we're back to is the basic position here, and it's dealing with essentially the fronting issue. And the fronting can occur in numerous ways. It could be sending an employee, sending a relative. In this case, actually, it's more egregious. It's Mike Burwald who shows up and says, I'm C&M Dairy. So he doesn't even bother to use a front man. He just goes there at least in most of the cases, 90% of the cases with Simples, and 10% he does send a relative. He sends his father, and then in that case, it's just like the Huffnagel case. Instead of a minor son, he sends his father. But in both cases, what's clear, and that's why this case is really important, is if it's that easy to get out of a security interest, either by sending someone else or showing up and lying, then everybody has to reevaluate the premises upon which they make secured loans.
If we rule in your favor on that point, what's going to happen in the next case where, say, C&M Dairy is a bona fide partnership with the Burwalds? It's a common law partnership. And say that there's a third partner involved in C&M Dairy, and they are not disclosed. Simple doesn't know about them. Under your interpretation, if that third partner is listed or created a security interest and is listed, they're going to be deemed to have known about them, even though C&M Dairy was a legitimate partnership. And say Arlen delivered the cattle. Now that result isn't going to be the right result, is it?
Your Honor, I think the focus, as Mr. Schaefer would like it, is whether the buyer is deemed to have known. And as explained by the Minnesota court, the knowledge of the buyer is not what's going to is not what will drive the case. Okay? They're going to have to take precautions in clearing out whether they're accounting for other security interests. And if they don't, they act at their peril. Now, of course, they do have an option in bankruptcy. And if I may briefly address that, at this point, we are fairly far down the road when it comes to the bankruptcy. The Chapter 11 plan has been confirmed, and under Chapter 11 rules, the case actually has been closed. The case could be reopened, but the case has been confirmed. The Burwalds, with respect to Fine Ag, basically are paying interest only for 5 years, and they have a balloon payment coming up. So basically in 2009, they have to find refinancing. Now, whether they're going to be able to do that is a real question, because there hadn't been any really progress made on the loan itself. They're just making interest-only payments. As to whether the defendants in this case would have a subordinated claim, I would say I don't think so by reason of the bankruptcy rules. They may well have a subordinated claim if they would ultimately settle with us and buy into our position. I don't know, but at least what they do have is the possibility of petitioning to reopen the case to file a claim if it's accepted. It clearly would be a non-dischargeable debt. And I do think they have that remedy. But as pointed out by the statute, I mean, if we have certain time constraints to mitigate our damages, and we did by filing this case and also participating in the bankruptcy, they also have some time elements that they have to pay attention to as well. Although they never have received any notice about the bankruptcy case, so I suspect that they do have a possibility of filing a late claim.
Before you leave, assuming you win on the policy argument, assuming you win on the lender argument, aren't all the other questions still subject to a genuine issue of material fact as to waiver, as to conversion, as to proximate cause, as to mitigation of your damages? Doesn't that have to be remanded to the trial court, even if you win on the front end?
Respectfully, no, because the statute does not account for that in terms of infinite. I think the example would be the Huffnagel case.
The what?
The Fine Ag versus Huffnagel. I believe that those issues do not trump the question of whether a buyer can take free of a security interest that is held by an undisclosed owner.
Thank you, Mr. Van Pitt. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes, and we'll come back and finish up. All right, continuing on with what we'll describe as the Fine Ag cases, Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the outset, I think it's very clear from Judge Rush's opinion that there was no evidence of any collusion whatsoever between the Burwalds and Simples in this case. In fact, one of the points that Judge Rush made in his opinion where he distinguished the Huffnagle case was that he believed in that case there was evidence of collusion. In fact, he pointed out in Huffnagle, one of the debtors, the sales made by these second or third parties was by the debtor's five-year-old child. And clearly in Huffnagle, there was also no evidence that Fine Egg in that case had any knowledge of these fronting sales or that somebody else, or that they were doing business under another name. Now, I think Huffnagle is distinguishable because it was a second seller or fronting case. This is a DBA case. And what Judge Rush found in his opinion to be where Fine Egg fell down was clearly this is a case where the security interest was created by the sellers. The Burwalds are the sellers under a DBA C&M Dairy. What Judge Rush said in his opinion, the problem that he had was under the exception that they tried to bring themselves under, which is E3, which again says that in the case of a farm product produced in a state that has established a central filing system, the buyer receives from the Secretary of State written notice specifying both the seller and the farm product being sold by such seller as being subject to an effective financing statement. And that's where Fine Egg loses, in Judge Rush's opinion, because they never included C&M Dairy that would have given Simples notice under the exception that that was subject to an effective financing statement, and he specifically said that in his opinion. And that's where they fell down, and that's where they completely have failed to try to argue in this case. They just say, we're covered by that exception because we filed with the Secretary of State, Simples got the master list, and the court can assume that they got notice. That's not what that notice exception says. That notice exception clearly says that it has to specify both the seller and the farm product being sold by that seller as being subject to an effective financing statement. And they knew or had some indication or notice that the Burwalds did business as C&M Dairy. In fact, that lawsuit where they admitted that, attached to that complaint was a bill of sale from Calvin and Michael Burwald, DBA C&M Dairy, for 150 head of Holstein heifers to Van Beek. So they knew or were certainly put on notice that the Burwalds were buying and selling cattle under that name, and if we're going to get notice to buyers under the Food Security Act, then we have to put them on there. Otherwise, we've essentially reverted back to pre-FSA days, and which is, I think, what Huffnagle did. Now, the other thing that I thought was interesting in the Huffnagle decision, and I think it's a little bit disingenuous by the Minnesota Supreme Court, is the Food Security Act says created by the seller. Huffnagle says in the opinion that that language came from 9307 of the UCC. That's not true. The language from 9307 says created by his seller. The language from 9320, the gender neutral one, says created by the buyer's seller. So it's a more restrictive concept. And essentially, the Minnesota Supreme Court, I think, misread that. I think they clearly didn't look at the legislative history because I got copies of the briefs that were submitted and nobody cited the legislative history which indicated that the intent of Congress was that these people take free of any security interest unless the buyers receive notice of the lien. And where they fall down in their argument is under the exception. Because the notice that they gave isn't sufficient. And the statute and the regulations governing material changes talk about, it says, the regulation said the basis for this requirement of amending your notice, if there's a material change, it says the basis for this is the purpose for which the information is supplied. That is to make information available to a buyer, commission merchant, or selling agent who proposed to enter into a transaction in a product as to whether it's subject to a security interest. I mean, that's the whole purpose of it.
What about his argument that the CFRs only apply to change of debtors, not collateral?
I don't think that's true, because actually the CFRs indicate that they are required to list somebody on their, it says whether or not a debtor. They don't have to be a debtor to list them on the EFS. The Code of Federal Regulations specifically requires them to list somebody that may subject somebody to a security interest, whether or not a debtor. And we cited that in our brief. That language is in there. I think Mr. Van Patten's argument is sort of turns the Food Security Act on its head. Essentially, he's saying that we don't have any defenses to it now, because if they win under the Food Security Act, they just win, and the common law defenses to conversion don't apply. Well, that's not true. All of the defenses apply, as Justice Sabers indicated. If it were going to be reversed, it'd have to go back, because Judge Rush never addressed any of the issues regarding waiver, estoppel, damages, failure to mitigate damages, or any of those issues, because he ruled strictly on the Food Security Act.
He didn't get to created by the seller either, did he?
He, I think, assumed. He didn't address it,
yeah.
Other than, I think he assumed that the Burwalds were the sellers, but where he addressed the seller was in that exception E3. And he says that's where they fell down, because he says, when I look at that and I look at the fact that they knew that the Burwalds were doing business to C&M Dairy and didn't put it on the EFS, how simple's to know? And my question is this. I mean, essentially they're trying, Professor Van Patten would take us back to the pre-FSA days and simply ignore this. Congress passed this statute, specifically made findings that says to prevent double payments by buyers like my client, because it says certain state laws permit a secured lender to enforce liens against a purchaser of farm products, even if the purchaser does not know that the sale of the product violates the lender's security interest in the products and lacks any practical method for discovering the existence of the security interest. That's this case. If this case isn't the case that this statute was intended to cover, then I'd like to know what case is. I don't have anything else to say other than I think Judge Rush should be affirmed, because I think he got it right when he looked at the exception in E3, and that's where he talked about we can't tell that any of these farm products are subject to an effective financing statement, because Fine Ag knew or should have known that the Burwalds were doing business at C&M Dairy, should have put them on there, because the whole policy of the Food Security Act is to place the policing of the loan, the burden, on the lender and not the buyer. That's the whole policy of it. And they never did that here. And if they would have, we wouldn't be here. And the other thing is, my client tells me, well, what can we do? I mean, are they supposed to put every Burwald's name from Dual County on the check, and every bank that shows up on the EFS that has a security interest in any Burwald in Dual County? And if we're going to do that, and we go to Potter County or some other county where we got 100 Rausches, are we supposed to do that? We have 24 hours to pay under the Packers and Stockyards Act for any cattle that are delivered to us. And the whole purpose of the Food Security Act was to deal with this situation where we're not obligated to go out and investigate and do this thing. The lender was obligated to do it. It didn't do it here. They were the person that had the knowledge or information that could have prevented this, and they failed for whatever reason to put C&M Dairy on the effective financing statement. And the only person that's going to be punished under this scenario is my client, a totally innocent purchaser. And that's not right. And that's what the Food Security Act was designed to prevent.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Henderson, you have 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I believe it was Justice Sabers who, near the end of Fine Egg's presentation, asked the question, if we find that that Watertown livestock here is not protected by the Food Security Act, doesn't fall within the protections, aren't there still issues of fact as to damages, causation, waiver, mitigation of damages, application of the rule of avoidable consequences? Aren't there still issues of fact? And I believe that the response was that, well, no, because the FSA doesn't contemplate that. And the thing is the FSA does not relieve them of their burden of proving conversion. The FSA provides a safe harbor, a protection for commission merchants, for buyers. But if they don't fall within that, they still have to prove a conversion claim in order to recover. They still have to prove all of the elements of that claim. What Fine Egg wants here is they want the best of all worlds. They want to say, the FSA doesn't help you because it doesn't protect you. You don't fall within the scope of the FSA's protection. At the same time, they want to say, oh, and by the way, the FSA relieves us of our burden of proving a state law conversion claim. My reading of the cases is that if the FSA does not provide protection, and I think this is consistent with their reliance on pre-FSA conversion cases, you got to prove a state law conversion case. In this case, they haven't done that. I want to address the Benning case briefly, Security State Bank versus Benning, which is 433 Northwest 2nd, 232. Benning is important, I think, for I guess, three reasons. One, it absolutely recognizes that damages are an essential part of recovery. You can't recover for conversion unless you can prove damages. What happened in that case is it's a similar deal. It's a creditor who brought a claim against a third-party buyer. I believe it was of corn in that case, and contending that the corn was there was an unauthorized sale by the debtor to the buyer, brought a conversion claim. The court granted summary judgment on the issue of liability with respect to conversion, granted partial summary judgment, but said the issue of damages has to go to the jury. The jury returned a verdict awarding no damages, even though there was, I think, in excess of $90,000 still owed on the loans. So I think clearly Benning stands for the proposition that you have to, that's part of your elements of your conversion claim, you have to prove damages. It also recognizes that mitigation of damages principles apply in that context, and also that the rule of avoidable consequences, which is 918 of the Restatement Second of Torts, which states that you can't recover for harm that could have been avoided through reasonable effort or expenditures on your part. Fine Egg wants to say that, well, Benning, it kind of goes back to their other contention, that Benning doesn't apply because it's a pre-FSA case. The thing is, Benning doesn't have anything to do with establishing liability for conversion or establishing whether or not a party takes subject to a security interest. The focus there is on damages, and I would submit that even if the FSA does not provide any protection for Watertown livestock in this case, Benning's analysis of the damages and its recognition of damages as an essential element of a conversion claim still holds true. A couple other things I'd like to point out briefly. Mr. Van Patten has talked a little bit about whether in bankruptcy, whether we would have any sort of subrogation type claim. And my understanding seemed to indicate that we probably did not. And he would certainly know better than I would. But I want to point out that if that's the case, then not only is the third party the one on the hook here, but the only party that really stands to benefit if you were to rule in favor of Fine Egg is the bad actor here, the fraudulent debtor. They're the ones who will have Feinegg wins on all of these cases before the court, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 million. They're the ones that will receive the benefit of that, because then they won't have, that's going to be applied, as I understand it, against Feinegg's loan. And the balloon payment they make at the end of the bankruptcy Chapter 11 plan will be reduced by that amount. I'd also like to point out that they've acknowledged that that there can be no allegation of collusion in the case of Watertown Livestock, so I don't think that that's an issue before the court based upon their acknowledgement.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.